Good afternoon. This is Monday, February 20th, 1 p.m., and this is a public hearing for the Subcommittee on Education for Ways and Means. We're going to just make one shift in our agenda this afternoon. We will start with Senate Bill 1539 and then just continue on with the agenda as presented. So with that, I'm going to open here at public hearing on Senate Bill 1539, and let's get a review of that.
Chair Comp, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1539 comes to you from the Senate Committee on Education and Workforce Development. It establishes a task force on virtual school governance for purpose of recommending governance structures for virtual education that is provided statewide. There is no revenue. There is a minimal fiscal impact statement issued, and should have that in your packets from SharePoint.
Okay. Any questions on that brief overview? Okay, we have testifying today Senator Beyer and Representative Dembrough. Please come forward and share your wisdom and thoughts with us about this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, for the record, I'm Lee Beyer. I have the pleasure of representing District 6 in the Oregon Senate, and I'm also a member of the existing, I don't think we disbanded, Virtual Schools Task Force, and I'm here today to encourage your support of Senate Bill 1539, which would continue the task force and add a few minor little changes of it. I think the legislature, in its wisdom in the last session, of which I was not a part, created the task force and to try and clarify some of the administrative provisions around virtual schools. Unfortunately, the task force had a hard time getting started as we waited for the governor's appointees, which actually didn't happen until just barely before the date when we were supposed to submit a report. But we have a good group that's impaneled now that would continue, and I think we're going to add to that. I think it's important work for the education in Oregon to consider this. Virtual schools certainly have a place in our educational makeup, and I think this will give us the opportunity to thoughtfully consider that and bring back a report to the Assembly for 2013. So with that, I would turn it over to the actual chair of the task force.
Okay, thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair, co-chairs, honorable colleagues. Michael Dembrough, State Representative, House District 45, Northeast Portland, out to Park Rose. And as the Senator said, what we're seeking here is an extension of the sunset for the task force. The task force was created at the very end of the last session. The appointments from the governor didn't happen until October, but they were very good appointments. We have two members from the House, two from the Senate, that is one from each party. In addition, someone from the Department of Education, Cindy Hunt, a superintendent, Gary Temple from SIO is on that group, Jim Sager, who's working for an ESD now on these issues. Good group of people. We have in the bill that's before you, which is requesting the extension of the sunset, we are adding two additional members to the task force, two parents, whose child is in an online charter school and one whose child is in an online non-charter school. One of the big changes that we're looking for in the work of this task force is to look at online education in its entirety, not just in the venue of the charter schools, which are certainly part of it, but increasingly, I think most people understand that online education needs to be an important component in all kids' education. And the future is with more hybrid models. Other states have really gotten out front in looking at their online education very globally. This state has not, As a result, we've kind of bounced from session to session with this issue. It's been very frustrating. What we're asking for here is for you to allow the task force to really look at the issue in the way that it deserves. This bill was this recommendation was a unanimous recommendation from the task force and a unanimous recommendation from the Senate committee.
Okay.
I think both of us would be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for our colleagues?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Co-Chair Springer.
Thank you, Co-Chair. And I'm sorry, Representative Dimbro, I'm just taking a quick look here at the bill. So I know last session the parents weren't included. I'm glad to see that they are now. How did that happen? How did we get this through without parents being involved in the process? First go around.
If you can take your mind back to the end of June 2011, when the bill that this was part of was created, everything was very helter-skelter. And the creation of the task force was kind of a last-minute, end-of-session sort of thing. And it was to my regret that there were no parents involved. But that's how the bill that came to us through the reconciliation bill, that's how it was crafted. So I think we're making a good fix here.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Monroe.
One more time, good reason why we're meeting annually.
Representative Shields. Oh, sorry. Senator Shields.
I've been demoted, actually. I'm now a senator. thank you very much, Madam Chair. If you can take some indulgence from me, I wanted to recognize a very important constituent of mine who's in the room. Her name is Camille Lawrence. She attends Chief Joseph Elementary, and she's a little bit bashful, but we just wanted to let you know, Camille, how grateful we are that you're here, and welcome to your capital. Thank you, Madam Chair.
It's nice to see you here, Camille. I have a question that's similar to Co-Chair Springer, and well, the question I have is why no teachers are on this task force?
I thought there was one.
Must have been a good question.
I'm on it, Madam Chair. That is, yeah,
Somebody that's not a legislator, that's a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
I will clarify that.
I hear you. I'm not sure. I think there was a desire to keep the committee small. We did have a task force in the previous interim,
right?
That was quite large, actually, and perhaps in hindsight, overly large. And I don't know, maybe someone had a concern about that, but I'm not sure. That's just how it was put together.
Representative Girard.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Either of you gentlemen can respond to this. If your task force is continued, what would be your most pressing issue as you continue?
Well, I think the most direct charge to the task force is come up with the administrative structure for how the state deals with this thing. That's particularly true of the charter virtual schools, but I think that in general, that's kind of the core issue. But beyond that, I think it's the long-term better interest is, as Representative Dimbro was saying, is how do virtual schools or virtual education fit in with the overall thing. I think the focus a lot has been on, as I've watched it, I wasn't part of the assembly the last time you talked about this, has been on the charter schools, but I know from my district, Superintendent Nancy Golden has been very involved in trying to figure out a way to work it into the curriculum in the Springfield School District, and I've heard the same from the neighboring school districts. I think I have six school districts, but who particularly, I think, what we used to call TAG, the talented and gifted, providing opportunities in small schools that they just can't provide on their own. I think there's an opportunity there. It's just being able to meet the individual needs of students, some of which don't fit in the regular classroom and have different interests.
Okay, thank you.
And I'll follow up on that, Madam Chair and Representative Girard. During the last interim, the State Board of Education was tasked with looking at this issue yet again and making some recommendations. And they had recommendations regarding a number of things, and a couple of the most pressing ones were the need to have some kind of statewide involvement in making sure that there's quality control in the vendors who are providing the online education. And so what the state board recommended was some kind of process where any vendor that's going to provide education in Oregon would become certified by a body that could, you know, assure the level of quality. For me, in principle, that sounds like a good idea. But how exactly do you make it work? Who does that certify? I mean, there are a lot of questions involved. And I think that is a pressing question. There are also some questions that, you know, they wanted us to address having to do with the, you know, the funding of the online charter schools. Currently, the reimbursement rate or the rate for high school students is 90% of FTE, I think, and for K-8 students it's 80% of the funding formula. Is that right? Does that make sense? Who should be looking at that issue? Who should be considering it? So that's also something I think that the group, you know, should look at. And then finally, one of the strong recommendations that the board had was that, you know, currently we only address online education through the charter school law. And they felt that we should be separating, we should have a separate area of statute for online education so that the aspects of the online charters which are relevant to charter school would be addressed through the charter law, but those that are relevant to online education, issues of quality and other things that they would share with other regular school districts, those should be in a separate set of statutes. So I see us looking at those as well.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Springer.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And just to maybe tag on to a little bit of what Representative Gard was saying here, and certainly both you gentlemen gave some pretty complete answers. As I look at this issue, and I know the task force or the bill here delineates some objectives, but as I look at the online education issue, I kind of put it in two buckets, one of which is, and Senator Beyer, you were talking about this, the schools accessing different classes and different things to supplement, which is great, which schools are doing. Mm-hmm. They're doing it, and they know what they're doing, and they have control and purview over that, just like they do their textbook adoption and like they do curriculum, all sorts of pieces. And so that's occurring. So for that purpose, I don't necessarily see the need for a task force to look at that. And then the other bucket I put this issue in is the governance and who controls it and how it's controlled. And that, I think, is probably the more difficult conversation in this arena. And when we talk about certified vendors, which is an interesting concept, and so then when we look at those, and this is one of the concerns, frankly, that I have, is if we're going to certify vendors for this job, are we certifying vendors for all these other pieces? Because we've historically, and trusted our school boards and our administration to be wise stewards of the funds and access the private vendors they need, which they've been doing for years and years. And so I think those are really the two buckets. We get to answer for ourselves if this task force addresses those appropriately or not. But that's kind of how I look at this issue. And the one I think is being dealt with very well, the same way it's always been dealt with, which is teachers and administration are saying this is what we need. My son goes to a public high school where they access some online classes here and there, and I'm choosing to trust them in that process as they go through that. So I look at it in those two buckets. I'd maybe encourage that.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Springer, I would add that I don't necessarily disagree at all with you. I reflect back on discussions I've had with Superintendent Golden and others, and part of her frustration, and frankly, then Superintendent of Eugene 4J as well, is they wanted to take advantage, and frankly, they are of some of the online, but they're saying, you know, we really are not in a position to know, you know, what's a good course, what's a bad course, from different things. It would be helpful to us if somebody, and they were thinking the State Department of Education, could take on the investigation, if you will, and say, and have a recommended list, and maybe even negotiate state contracts where they could say, okay, I've got a gifted student who wants an advanced trigonometry course, and they could, a teacher in the district could call up and make that thing without having to do hours of research that they're not really prepared to do. And I think there's a value in that. We really don't have that system in place, although I know that some of the education service districts, for example, some of them are starting to do that work. I'm not sure it's the best way.
Madam Chair, if I could just add one last thing. You know, we are dealing with a pretty unique creature here, you know, in that, you know, the vendors in this case are different than just someone who's offering some services. This is a total education package that's being offered. And also what's unique about it is that most of the students in the school may not be from the sponsoring district. And so we do have a statewide responsibility here, I think, because the students are coming from all over the state, you know, into the school. So it's not a simple question of, you know, if you have a problem, go to your local school district or vote out your school district member. This is a kind of a unique creature, and so it really, I think we need to look at it really very thoroughly. Most states do have a certification process for their online providers, and I think it would be useful for Oregon to look into that.
Thank you. Any further comments from the members?
I'm really having trouble hearing with all the... I'm not supposed to be in the Capitol.
To the state police.
Yeah, I'm sure they'll be dealt with soon.
Where are our guards?
What now?
Where is security?
They're moving, I think.
Get the security in. I'm not trouble getting that in here because.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes. You through with us?
Yes, thank you for your testimony.
You may not leave the room.
just a second. Senator Girard, did you have a question for either of these? Okay, thank you. Okay, we are still on record. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1539, and I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 4056. John.
Chair Comp, members of the committee.
Just a minute. Eric, are they moving along?
Yeah.
Thank you.
In which direction are
they? Well, they were going that way, and now they're going this way.
House Bill 4056 comes to you from the House Committee on Higher Education. It creates a task force on STEM, which is an acronym for Science, Technology, Engineering, and Mathematics. The task force on STEM access and success. They are charged to research and report on strategies for encouraging students to study science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. There's a minimal fiscal impact for the task force. The bill also creates a STEM fund to be continuously appropriated to the Oregon Student Access Commission for the purpose of providing scholarships. The bill allows the task force to accept grants, donations, contributions, but at this time there's no donations that have been identified.
Okay. Thank you, John. Okay. We have two people that signed up to testify, Jim Craven and Nikki Tirza.
Yep. And Rep. Johnson's going to present it.
Oh, is Rep. Johnson? Are you here to testify too?
That,
Representative, come on down.
Yeah, that's tough.
Absolutely. Would you like these two other wonderful professionals to join you?
You know, that would be great, just for a little support, certainly. Thanks for allowing us to occupy these chairs for a
good time. I'm not going to respond to that. Normally I would have some little quip, but no way today.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, Mark Johnson, State Representative for House District 52. Today I'd like to just, the bill we're going to talk about, House Bill 4056, was a committee bill for our House Higher Ed Committee. I would say that it probably had as much excitement behind it, I think, as any piece of work that we did as a committee. Very, very supportive testimony from multiple different proponents, both within the private sector, within the public sector, from students and so forth. And basically, it's just an idea of focusing attention on STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, and for us as a state, as the state of Oregon, I think, to really get serious about the potential for what we can do within our K-12 world to increase these opportunities, to increase the awareness of the potential for profitable careers within this field. I think as a workforce development tool, I think it's incredibly significant. But if there's one thing we've heard time and time again, and I'm sure you have as well, that our private sector industries are looking for a more highly trained workforce. And I think that the more we can do as a state to emphasize the importance of STEM and make those kind of opportunities available within our school system, our public school system within the state, it's a win-win for everybody within the state of Oregon. So basically, it calls for the creation of a 16-member task force to develop strategies that will encourage students to study. And it's also going to create a STEM fund that can be contributed to via private sector income and so forth, contributions that could be administered in the form of scholarships, sponsorship of activities. There's just a wide range of opportunities here that for us. And just to give you a little local knowledge or a local background, STEM, we have such a fabulous connection within my own school district. There's an entity called the Gorge Technology Alliance, which is a consortium of private sector companies and businesses in the Columbia River Gorge who have partnered with our K-12 system and with our community college system to provide all kinds of opportunities, from sponsoring robotics competitions, electric car making competitions, and so forth. And we're talking about some fairly significant private sector investment from companies like Google and some of our other major players in the Gorge and so forth. So I know that there's ways we can replicate this and take it to a much larger scale on a statewide basis, but I would just certainly encourage your support of this concept. I think it moves us in the right direction, and I know you have some other proponents here to my left who would love to talk to you about that as well. So thank you for your time today.
Questions or comments for Representative Johnson?
I would have a question, and you might not know the answer to this, but is there any coordination with the TAG program and the STEM program?
Senator Girard, I would, that could vary district by district. I wouldn't know that there'd be a common answer for that. In some ways, in some areas, I do know that STEM opportunities kind of maybe supplanted some of the TAG programs that, you know, in these budget times, unfortunately, some of the TAG opportunities, I know at least locally in my district, and I know other districts as well, have fallen upon some tough times. So this could perhaps take the form of some of that, or provide TAG-like activities, if you will, to students who are interested in taking their academics to another level.
I like the idea. I think it's a great idea.
Well, John, could you remind us how much we allocated for this fund last session?
This is a new fund established by the measure.
Well, this one's a new fund, but we did give, we had, Nikki, if you want to identify yourself.
Thank you, Co-Chair, member of the committee, Nikki Terziev, representing First for Inspiration in for inspiration and recognition in science and technology. First is the acronym. Last session through capital construction and the Christmas tree bill, if you will, the state legislature was gracious enough to allocate $150,000 for us.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for Representative Johnson? Senator, yes?
We were discussing that was major allocation.
Well, I assure you, it as Nikki will tell us, probably some of the impacts.
I'm saying that they did wonderful with that, and we're being very supportive. In fact, as we would give, I would give more. How's that?
You're on the record.
Yes.
Representative Johnson, did you want to stay for the rest of the testimony? Yes, you're welcome to.
I'd be happy to be excused.
Okay. Please go.
One final comment I might make, if I may. I do think this focus on STEM does have an opportunity to help us as we talk about narrowing achievement gap here in Oregon, because I do believe this provides equal opportunity to students who may not culturally have an awareness of these subjects, but I can just tell you from what I've seen in my own district, this is a very inclusive program that provides opportunities for some of those students who don't come from family backgrounds, who know anything about STEM, but they are right side by side with everyone else competing in robotics, and they said in electric car making competitions and so forth as well. So I think it has real broad appeal in that perspective too, to help us all statewide to make some inroads in that area. But that'll let these more intelligent folks
thank you for
talk.
Your time.
Thank you.
Appreciate you bringing this bill forward to us.
Thank you. Co-chairs, members of the committee, again, I'm Nikki Terziev here representing FIRST. I would just like to thank you all for your hard work on this, and it's taken me a long time to get before this committee, but I am finally here and pleased to be so. I'll tell you, the $150,000, just to speak to your question, co-chair, was definitely well spent. We were able to bootstrap 20 teams across the state. We specifically chose a focus outside of the I-5 corridor. We wanted to make sure that students who were not in the backyard of Intel and who were not in the backyard of kind of Silicon Forest, if you will, had the same opportunities as those students who were inside the I-5 corridor and up and along there. It has been very impactful. We have seen, and I can provide testimonials for you all as this bill moves along in the process, impacts in lives and students in Union County, for instance. There is a team out there. They unfortunately are plagued with some gang issues out there. And in one particular place, it's true, in one particular place, in one particular school, we have members on the same robotics team from two rivaling gangs. And they come together. But it's an important piece, because what this shows is that education and hands-on education can bridge gaps that exist. And whether that's socially or whether that's economically, this kind of education and this kind of curriculum is going to move children into a place that they could never imagine for themselves. When you get professional mentors into your school and you're working with piles of nuts and bolts and hands-on, you're turning them into a moving robot. And this year in the competition, you're going to see robots that are being controlled by the Kinect system, which was donated by Microsoft, and it's the video gaming system. And so students will be able to control these robots without touching a joystick, just simply by the motion of their hands and the motion of their bodies. It's a really phenomenal thing. I would also be remiss if I didn't tell you all that on March 9th, we'll be having our regional competition in Memorial Coliseum, and you should join us.
Thank you, Nikki. Jim, how are you going to top that?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair. Tough act to follow, always. Jim Craven, representing two hats today, Tech America, the Broad Trade Association that represents the high-tech industry, as well as Intel Corporation directly. Just to echo my thanks, we had some great hearings. We had a really great hearing in Legislative Days in mid-January, and then we had another good hearing in front of the House Higher Education Committee, and we appreciate the really strong support on that committee, and particularly of the co-chairs, Representative Denbrown, Representative Johnson, and for really taking this bill and kind of making it their own. And that's always a great situation when you're not sitting here pleading, when you're saying, we love your bill, Representative Denbrough. you know, I've visited with many of you over the last 15 years on the ETIC project, which is the Engineering Technology Industry Council at the higher ed level. But really what we recognized early on, and even ETIC helps directly support, is what we call pipeline efforts. It bears little good to develop really world-class engineering programs at Oregon State and Portland State if you don't have a way to feed them with bright, young potential engineers and scientists. So it is a pipeline issue is very, very important. Oregon's been doing a lot along these lines, so this doesn't represent, this bill does not represent, hey, let's start. It represents, geez, there's proliferation of great programs. How do we make sure they're working together? Maybe we discover that they are. Maybe we discover that some more coordination would be helpful. Some more state initiatives would be helpful. So that's what this group is pledging to do in a fairly tight time period, and maybe even bring you some recommendations before next session starts. I do want to say on the record on behalf of Intel that Intel has provided a grant to the Oregon Business Council to advance STEM education, and both those organizations will have pledged to help in the work of this task force. I mean, they can't run a public body and be responsible for all the legal public notices and stuff, but as far as finding rooms and logistics and such, I think that's partly why you have a minimal fiscal impact, because some private sector believers in this process are going to step up to help make sure it's a success. So we urge your support and move this down the road, and we'll get back to you next year with some great results, we hope.
Great. Questions for either of these presenters? Senator Girard?
Oh, thank you. I'd just like to make a statement. I really do feel very strongly that any money that goes to either TAG, ETEC, STEM, anything that promotes technology, if we truly want jobs in this state, you need to put some money in the people that are going to create jobs. And all it takes is one person. I mean, Microsoft is a good example of that, with a brilliant idea, and it creates thousands of jobs. And so for the small amount of money, and I know it's hard for people out there, $150,000, that's a pretty small level for us. It pays huge dividends, and so I think you have a worthy cause.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Denbrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to follow up on Jim's comments about the pipeline, because that really is what this bill is all about. We had a hearing in the fall on an informational hearing. Rep. Springer was there in the House Higher Ed Committee on ETIC, and we heard about all the good work that's being done, and the high level of quality, the high level of the quality of the students. But when I asked about the how many of the students in the program were from Oregon, who had come up through the Oregon pipeline, the response was not enough. When I asked about the representation by students of color, even worse, right? And so, and it was really at that hearing that the idea for this bill was hatched. And it was very clear that this is not a problem that we're going to solve just through our school system. It's going to take a real community effort. And that's where the work that the kind of organizations that Nikki represents really come in. After school programs, before school programs, actually Nikki invited me to the kickoff of this year's first robotics competition, which sounded great, and I agreed immediately, and then she told me I had to be in Vancouver at 6:45, and it suddenly became less attractive. But the energy in that room was just huge, and a lot of the people in that room were from schools that had been funded thanks to that last allocation, that small allocation. So it was really, really exciting, and this is an exciting bill. I think I really appreciate Intel stepping up to the plate as they have, so that we could get the fiscal down and do the good work that I think will have really big dividends in the future. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Girard.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. It's not a question, Jim or Nikki. But I can't help it. I could not let the pipeline comment go by without mentioning Oregon Institute of Technology, which has all of the STEM in one school and who has despite our economy, over a 95% placement rate for its graduates. So you are right on when you talk about let's fill that pipeline as fast and as good as we can.
Co-Chair Sinbrenner.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So I was down with, they weren't STEM kids, as we're talking, it was FIRST, it was the robotics team, and I went and visited with some of the kids in my district and a neighboring district. And the reason I tell you this is the conversation that we had was pretty phenomenal for me, quite frankly, because we can all sit here and conceptually this sounds like a great idea, and I'm 110% on board. But what I learned in that room, shooting the T-shirt over the computer monitors. I did miss them, but I made sure the principal left first and hit the target. But so I talked to the kids and about what it was they were learning. And, of course, the science and the technology and the engineering, those pieces were there. But they were learning skills that ran a much wider gambit than that. And so I specifically called out a couple of them, and there was one gal who was definitely a public speaker. And I talked about not so much the math skills, but skills related to that. And I said, so tell me, they told me what they did with the robot. And I said, so tell me, where did you learn that? And this was not a process that I engaged in because I knew that it could be misconstrued what the school's doing right and what the school's doing wrong. No, that wasn't the intent at all. I said, so where did you learn that? Well, I didn't learn it in school. I learned it through this process. And the reason I make that point, and that statement was made 4-5 times over specific things that they've been doing, that statement isn't to say, wow, the school's dropping the ball. There was more than one school represented there. That statement is to say this is a great, believe it or not, low-cost way to augment what the school is doing. And there were partners there. I mean, the principal was there before I shot the T-shirt out, but principal was there and really partnered with them. But this is an opportunity to do all the things that we've talked about in addition to support schools and what they're doing and giving just another venue or avenue for these kids.
Thank you. Co-Chair Monroe.
Thank you. Jim, I actually was able to attend, I think it was about 2 years ago in the Coliseum, mm-hmm. and it's fantastic. Can you tell us the amount of the Intel grants that are their involvement in this, or is that secret?
Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, I am subbing here today. I neglected to mention to Morgan Anderson, Intel's Government Affairs and Education Coordinator, who testified at the previous hearings, was otherwise occupied today. I meant to say that in my testimony, so I don't have that, but I can get that information for you,
please.
As long as it's not secret.
Yeah. Well, the reason is, obviously, we put a very small amount of public money in, $150,000, and we like to know if that's leveraging additional resources from the private sector and how much. That's a good thing.
Absolutely.
Nikki, you had a response.
Yes, Madam Co-Chair, Senator Monroe, Co-Chair Monroe. Barring having the spreadsheet in front of me, I can tell you that FIRST took the $150,000 allocation that we received, and we leveraged it anywhere between, you could count 4-to-1 and 7-to-1. It's all private industry. It's all money. It comes from companies like Autodesk. It comes from companies like Intel. It comes from companies like Google. And, in fact, in Representative Johnson's district, Google has seeded 5 different teams, robotics competition teams there. So that small piece really goes to cover compensation for teachers who become coaches. Those are folks who spend hours at the school and on Saturdays the same as a basketball coach or a baseball coach or a football coach, but don't necessarily see that same stipend.
Thank you.
Well, I have to tell my own little story. When I went to the robotics competition a year or so ago, because they were setting up and all this other stuff, I had the opportunity to talk to some sixth graders, and I heard some of the very same things that Co-Chair Springer talked about, but I asked them, well, what time does their club meet? And it was like that, you know, before 7 o'clock in the morning. I said, well, don't you get tired? This was a group of 5 or 6 boys, sixth graders. And first of all, I've never seen sixth graders sit still very long, much less at that time of the morning. And they said, don't you get tired? And they go, oh, no. Universally, in that group, they shared, we don't sleep much. Their brains are so active that they literally do not sleep much. And then I did ask them the question about math, and I said, well, do you use anything that you... What from school do you use in your projects? Again, universally, nothing. And finally, I had to ask them one more question. I said, okay, when did you write your first program? One of them wrote his first computer program at the age of 5. I wish that was my child, but it wasn't. but they stole my heart, and I've been observing the robotics program in our school district for a number of years, but I want to thank you personally for your work on this, your energy. Nikki, I think, solo-handed this all during last session to bring this forward, and I know our students appreciate it, so thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. You're excused.
Thank you.
I see we have Representative Bailey here. Do we want to switch the agenda one more time?
Sure.
Oh, I need to close that one first. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4056.
Your pleasure, Madam Chair. I can hang out.
You sure you can hang out?
Sure.
Okay, well then we'll keep in our order the way we were. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4058 relating to higher education textbooks. I bet you Representative Dembro's fingerprints are on this too. John, give us an introduction.
Chair, comp members of the committee, House Bill 4058 comes to you from the House Committee on Higher Education. The measure directs the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to convene a work group to examine and recommend adoption of strategies for reducing higher education textbook costs. There is an indeterminate fiscal impact. The Higher Education Coordinating Commission, we need some more clarity on what exactly their staffing levels and budget will be before we know how this will be implemented.
Okay. And has LFO given them a timeline to, or how?
I'm not sure the budget conversation has taken place for their...
Okay, thank you. That's what I was wondering, how far along we were in the conversation. Representative Dembro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, Michael Dembro, House District 45. This bill, the Affordable Textbook Act, came to you last year. It was passed out unanimously from the Higher Ed Subcommittee. It then had another life and went before the Rules Committee and passed out of the Rules Committee again unanimously. We ran out of time at the end of the session. But that's not to say that there wasn't really broad-based support for what it was trying to do, which is to bring down the high cost of textbooks. As many of you know, the cost of textbooks has increased exponentially over the last years, in many cases faster than the cost of tuition. And for community college students, like my students, the cost of textbooks is in many cases higher than the cost of tuition for them. And it is really critical that we find ways to make that experience more affordable for them, because it's a very difficult creates a real burden on them, and in many cases students have no alternative but to not get the book and not do the reading, and it's very problematic. What this bill is calling for is it's calling for us to take advantage of our newly created Higher Education Coordinating Commission, which is coming into effect, into existence this July, to handle issues exactly like this. The Higher Ed Coordinating Commission's role is to convene groups of people to work on issues that are, you know, of interest and of need throughout the higher education world. We'll be hearing more about that, the HEC, the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission, on Wednesday, but it brings together people from the community colleges, the universities, the independent universities, the nonprofits, the for-profits, to look at ways that we can overcome the challenges of getting to 40-40-20, or the philosophy of expanding educational access. So what this bill will do is it will have the HEC authorize a group which will be coming from the universities and the colleges, faculty, students, bookstore managers, and other professionals, to take a look at some of the new technologies that are out there, and to look at ways in which partnerships between different universities, or, you know, perhaps even the entire OUS system, might lead to ways of bringing the costs down. Looking at things like online textbooks, open source textbooks, bulk purchases, group licenses, things that we're starting to see being pursued in other states. I think, Eric, did you pass out that handout? There was just an article in USA Today which talks about some of the things that some of the other states are doing to bring down the cost of textbooks in their states. We've learned that we can expect support from the Oregon Student Association, from the Oregon Community College Association, from the different faculty groups, the individual colleges and universities, to get on board and try to really get on top of this problem. I personally believe that with concerted effort, we could cut down the cost of textbooks by 50% in 3 to 5 years, and that would do enormous good for our students. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Representative Denbrough?
I got one.
Senator, go ahead.
The question I would have, and I think this is a good bill, and I got a big yes at the top of it, but the copyright infringement laws, have you gone into that at all with electronic books versus hard copy books? Because it seems to me like if we were to do a mass buy in electronic books, that should save a pile of money. I just don't know how that would correspond to the copyright laws.
Madam Chair and Senator Girard, you know, electronic books are normally covered by the same copyright restrictions as anyone is. And, you know, if you see someone inappropriately distributing, you know, copies of material that you've copyrighted, you know, you definitely want to go after them. And there are different online devices that help to track that. But, you know, one of the things that's growing currency, one of the practices that's growing in currency is the use of what's called open source textbooks, where instructors will create materials, will create actually entire textbooks that they are saying that practitioners in the field are free to take their material, alter it, that they have to, of course, give credit to, you know, to the source author for the work that they've done. But they can add things, add materials, customize them. You know, if it's a political science text, you're probably going to want to have more examples from your state, you know, that kind of thing. That is a very exciting prospect. Another thing that we're seeing is that the sort of division between online and in print is starting to disappear, right? There are many students don't feel comfortable in an all online environment, with e-readers or whatever. And so they would prefer to have a format where they could have an online option or an e-electronic option, but they would also like the ability to have the material as a PDF that they could then print off. And in fact, there is willingness on the part of college bookstores in working with the electronic producers, and they would then run off the PDFs version and make them available to students at a much, much lower cost. Actually, I just over the weekend got an email from some of my colleagues at PCC who are talking about creating a textbook for the pre-calculus course that's taught, you know, all over the state, of course. And they have a vision of making it an open source kind of thing, and wanted to talk to me about perhaps creating some partnerships where they could get some support for some release time, and that get some foundation money in order to create this. And they believe that the bookstores could then print this material for as little as $15. This is a college textbook that normally would be about $125. So, you do enough of that, and you're starting to make a real difference.
Any follow-up, Senator?
Oh, no, I'm
good. Okay. Representative Garrard?
Just a quick double check on something you said, Representative. Everybody knows price of everything is going up, but yet you said you could lower the cost of these textbooks by 50%, and you've just given us one example. Is that the example, or are, in other words, I'm assuming you're taking somebody's profit away from them?
There are a number of different models out there. Textbook rentals, use of used copies, right? And as I mentioned before, sort of group licenses to help bring down the cost, sort of similar to what we're doing with prescription drugs, right? Trying to, get a large group and you get a discount as a result. Yes, the publishers will still make a profit, but we'll be in a position to negotiate harder when we have the potential to take it statewide.
Quick follow-up.
Yes.
So what you're saying is you're not really reducing the cost of a certain textbook. You're talking about buying less textbooks by substituting...
For rentals, maybe.
Whatever means possible. You're just talking about the student not having to buy as many. So you're talking about the 50% savings is aimed at the student?
It is aimed at the student.
Okay.
Definitely, yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, Representative Denbrough. And I'm going to call up Emma Calloway. Did you have materials for us, Emma?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Eric.
And whenever you're ready, Emma.
Great, thank you. Good afternoon, co-chair, members of the committee. My name is Emma Calloway. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Student Association, and we'll have over 100 students in the building tomorrow, so none of them could make the trip today to be able to testify in front of you, so I'm the stand-in. What you're being handed is a testimony from our board chair. I will not be reading the entire testimony.
Thank you. You
can do that on your own. I wanted to just echo our support for this bill, and thank you very much, Representative Denbrough, for working so hard on lowering the cost of the individual student, which is really what we're hoping to do with this bill. A lot of members have asked me, why do you think you need a task force for this? Why can't this be done already? And I think that this is probably one of the best examples of when legislative involvement really does bring together groups of stakeholders that we haven't been able to successfully bring together previously. So bookstore owners and students and faculty, independent colleges, public universities, community colleges, really bridging the gap and talking about textbooks across the system is something that we think is very useful and really will lower the cost. One quick story that I wanted to share with you is that we have students at Lane Community College right now, some of which who are paying over $700 a term on math and science textbooks. And it really feels like Math 111 hasn't changed much in the last century. And so I can't for the life of me really figure out why we keep buying new versions of textbooks. Why can't we be maybe lowering the number of textbooks we buy while still hopefully recognizing that profit for companies, as Representative Garrard talked about, is very important. But there are ways to lower the cost for the individual. The average student is paying over $900 a year across the United States for textbooks, which is an exorbitant portion of public universities and community colleges. So with that, I'll just say that we very much hope that you support this bill and bring it to the floor for a vote soon.
Thank you. Any questions for Emma? Thank you for your time and testimony.
Madam Chair, can I say one other thing?
Sure, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in its original form, the bill also asked the task force, or the HEC through the task force, to look at potential savings that could devolve to the K-12 system. Because, you know, if you think about it, we're increasingly having courses in the high schools that are college courses, right, dual credit courses. And, you know, currently those courses, the materials are purchased by the school districts at great expense. And so it, you know, it seemed to me that this is also going to be a potential savings. And actually, a lot of districts around the country, K-12 districts, are looking at alternative textbook design as a way to bring down their, as a way of balancing their books. We unfortunately had to leave that out of the bill because it would have produced a $5,000 fiscal from the Department of Education to review that and agree with it or disagree with it. So I'm sure that the Commission will consider it, even though we don't tell them to. But I found that a little ironic.
Thank you.
So come down here in the end.
Yes.
I would just like to say that I think this is a great bill, but I think this group, we have an obligation to try to do everything we can to keep the cost of a college education down. And last session, I was a little bit disturbed by some of the funding that went out that, you know, I didn't think was quite equitable in the education arena. And I just, you know, you look at what's happened with tuition and the barrier to entry that is increasing with every dollar that tuition goes up, and that's a direct function to our colleges with their expenses. I mean, University of Oregon, the dean paid a pretty big I mean, he paid dearly for raising the cost of salaries, but I think that that's a part of it, but also the funding from this body and from Ways and Means and everything in general. And if we can do anything to help bring down the cost for college students, I think that we should do what we can.
Thank you. Appreciate your comments. Senator Monroe?
Yeah, a little story. When I was going to college 50 years ago, I had a scholarship which covered
Senator,
yes?
There's a question. Did you say 150?
No, just 50.
Okay.
I was on a scholarship which covered my tuition, but it didn't cover my books. And so I remember one term, my books came to over $100. Doesn't sound like much today, but we're talking 50 years ago. And I got really angry and said some things, and my father just came unglued. Now, my father went to college during the Depression, and he was very poor, ended up earning 5 college degrees, including a doctorate, but he said, "I don't want to ever hear you complain about the price of books." He said, "When I was in college, I couldn't afford a book. I had to do all my reading in the library and scrape by." And so my dad was really usually kind of a pacifist kind of guy. I mean, he didn't get angry easily, but man, he was mad. And so I didn't talk about price textbooks around him ever again.
Madam Chair, can I just say, actually, you know, you raise a good point, Senator, that, you know, in the past we have had that opportunity to put books on reserve and students could come and use that, and that it's still done, but it's increasingly a challenge because so often now students have to work while they're going to school, and they're not spending as much time on campus as they used to, and it becomes almost impossible for them to access those reserved materials. So, you know, we got to get them a way to have their textbooks at home.
Yep.
And the only comment I'd make to this discussion in K-12 education, when we're in a budget crisis, the first thing that gets cut out of the budget is books.
That's right.
And so then you're using books that, well, the science certainly can't keep up, much less the history. So thank you for everybody on the testifying on this. I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 4058, and we are going to switch people here. And we have a number of people, and we do have time signed up for our next bill. And so I'm going to open a hearing on House Bill 4077.
Co-chairs, member of the committee, House Bill 4077 comes to you from the House Committee on Human Services. It requires each school district board, to adopt a policy that stating that teen dating violence is unacceptable and prohibited. There is no revenue impact, and there is a fiscal impact, and I believe you have that in your package.
Okay, thank you. And we're going to lead off, I believe, with Representative Bailey. Do we have any member of the committee speaking on this? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jules Bailey. I represent House District 42, and I will try to be brief, but I want to walk you through a little bit of the history of this bill because we have a wonderful group of people behind me who are getting ready to come up and testify on this bill, and I'm sure we'll be much more eloquent than I can be. You may recognize this bill because we discussed a similar concept in the last session around this, what we're calling the Healthy Teen Relationship Act, and I want to talk about just a little bit about the history because and why we're doing this, because the bill has shifted since the concept that you heard last session. And I'm pleased to be able to co-chief sponsor this bill with Representative Matt Wand and with Senator Lori Moss Anderson. So it's not just bipartisan, it's even more rare, it's bicameral. but with the help of the co-chief sponsors, I think we've made this a much better bill and one that has attracted an enormous amount of support. When we first started working on this concept and started working with Raphael House of Portland around a bill to address what is really an epidemic in our society, which is violence against young women in dating relationships, we started to realize that the fundamental issue went much more deeply than that, and that it wasn't just about addressing violent aspects. It's also about addressing the fundamental root causes of how people engage in and understand what constitutes a healthy relationship, and that an unhealthy relationship is one that doesn't necessarily just manifest in violence, but that might manifest in controlling behavior or a mental or emotional abuse that might then lead to relationships that manifest in violence later on in life, but might not right away. And we were reminded that of how important this bill is. Shortly after introducing it, a young woman in, I believe, Representative Denbrough's district, went missing and from a relationship in which it was assumed that perhaps her boyfriend had been involved in her disappearance. And shortly after the legislature adjourned, she was found and had been murdered by her boyfriend. And I attended that memorial service, and the impact that had on the community was shocking. It rips apart a community, it rips apart a family, and especially when that violence is so personal and so close to home. this bill really comes from a place of that old adage that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And that the fact is that while that particular instance resulted in violence, many of these relationships don't have to result in violence. And that's really what this is about. It's getting at that core of what a healthy relationship is. And it can affect the arc of someone's life. It can affect incarceration rates and graduation rates and drug use and future domestic violence and really what the state spends on all of those services in addition to the quality of life. And at its core, this is about empowerment. This is about helping young girls and young boys understand that they have the power to control their own destinies, their power to say no when they mean no, and to seek help when they need to seek help. It's also not just about avoiding the bad. It's about creating good outcomes as well. We heard in the policy committee testimony from the Oregon District Attorneys Association, which supports the bill, that they believe that this will actually lead to better juries. When juries understand what a healthy relationship is and isn't, that we'll have a more empowered jury in domestic violence cases. And that was, I think, a really interesting and important point. Now, I want to express my thanks to Lori Satenspiel from Oregon School Boards Association for convening a meeting with Representative Wand and Senator Montes Anderson at the Gresham Barlow School District. We've worked very closely with the school districts to make sure that this is not an unfunded mandate on them, that this is not an additional burden. It piggybacks on existing curriculum. It creates a permissive use of funds around domestic violence prevention money and builds off the policies and the curriculum that these school districts have gone through as a result of the bullying statute. I also want to finally note that there is a $28,000 fiscal for the survey portion, for adding a module onto the Healthy Teen Survey to track some of the data that comes out of this. The sponsors believe, and I believe I can speak for my co-chief sponsor here, that tracking that data is incredibly important. However, I would note that we have drafted an amendment and given it to the committee, should you so choose, that would remove that portion of the bill, leaving the policy portions in place, and would, I believe, bring the fiscal cost of this bill to zero. So we leave that to the committee's discretion. With that, I will turn it over.
Representative Wand, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Matthew Wand, State Representative from House District 49. I don't think I can say anything any better than Representative Bailey just has, but I'd like to say one thing. I wish that we lived in a world and in a community and in a society where this bill was totally unnecessary, where every single student in Reynolds School District came from an intact, healthy family, and that they learned by observing the intact family how to have a healthy relationship of a romantic nature with others. I also know that that is kind of like a unicorn, and it doesn't exist. Not every child has that. And if we can take just a small step that doesn't impede or trample on any other important values such as local control, to try to help a few of those kids in my district that come from those broken homes, then we should do so. Like I said, as long as it matches up with our other values, let's take the opportunity to try and reach some of those kids. And this bill has been carefully crafted to do just that. So I hope that the committee will move this to the floor for a vote. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions for our presenters today? Senator Gerard.
Yes, this is for Representative Wand. I just want you to know I kind of read through the bill, and yeah, I usually might have some questions, but since you wore such a beautiful tie, I think this
I have a crack research staff.
Co-Chair Monroe.
Yeah, you gentlemen need to know that we get our orders from the big co-chairs. And so far, they've only given us the authority to hear this bill. And we will, the three of us,
disclaimer,
co-chairs, will meet hopefully right after this meeting and determine which of these bills we think ought to be moved on. And then we inform the big co-chairs, and they make the ultimate decision, not only whether or not to move them forward, but whether they're moved forward by this subcommittee or by capital construction. That's just the way it is. So we appreciate your input, we have limited authority at this time.
Thank you for that, and we hope to catalyze your enthusiasm on this as in that discussion.
And my only comment would be to my co-chair, please don't think Representative Springer and I feel that way.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I would like to comment. I think I'm the only one on the dais that doesn't take the orders from the big three. So.
I have a real question.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So I know a little bit about this bill, maybe. So I guess I just would put the question out there. I heard unfunded, that it's not an unfunded mandate, which is great and leaves local control. And then you talked a bit about the allows some funds to be used for this. So I'm trying to think in my districts. My large district is a not very large district, but and my others are much smaller. So I'm thinking as this goes home to them, how they do this. So it's not an unfunded mandate, so they don't have to do anything. It's permissive, and stop me if I've missed this. Where I'm going with this is, if it's permissive, does allow them to access some funds, I appreciate that. They do have to make some changes in their policy. If it doesn't require a lot, is it doing anything? That does not take away from the problem, but sometimes we focus so much on solving a problem, and this is a very serious problem. We focus so much on solving the problem that we don't maybe match the right solution to the problem. I'm not saying this isn't the right solution. I'm just saying if it doesn't require much, then what's going to actually happen?
Co-Chair, Representative Springer, I think that's an excellent question, and I would respond to that in a couple of ways. One, I would say I think down here in this body we are focused on the art of the possible, and that this is a very important step, but I would not misconstrue that important step with all the steps that are necessary to solve what is a fundamentally systemic issue. But what this bill does do, which I think is critically important, is that for the first time, it will call out teen dating violence in a policy that will separate it from what is sometimes confused with, but is not the same as, for example, sexual violence. Now, sexual violence obviously also prohibited, but we have existing statutes and ways to deal with that in law enforcement. What we need to start now is inculcating a culture that violence and relationships begins well before it reaches that stage of sexual violence, and it builds into that policy, into district policy, that this itself is prohibited, and that's a very important step in recognition. In addition to the permissive use of funds for domestic violence providers to be able to address prevention and not just response. There's a situation now, as I think many of you know, if a teacher, for example, notices an instance where a young girl or a young boy is engaged in a very unhealthy relationship, and they have concerns about that student's welfare and potential safety in the future, even if actual violence hasn't occurred yet, their only recourse is really to report that to child services, and that's not really a structure that is set up to deal with that. That's about adult on child interactions. And so what this bill does is ask school districts, as part of the process that they have to go through to create plans and designate a point person on bullying that the legislature has already mandated, to specifically call out within those plans that subset around teen dating violence, so that at least the school districts start the process of planning of how to deal with these things as they're reported and as they're discovered. And one of the reasons I think you see in a letter that's being sent around an endorsement of this bill from the Oregon Education Association is that there's a recognition that this is empowering teachers as well as students to be able to understand and to address this. And obviously they're looking out for the well-being of teachers and aren't looking for a mandate on teachers to be cops or to take on roles roles that they're not able to take on. But this gives them and empowers them to help get involved and know better through a district policy of what the right actions are and what the right steps are. If they start to notice these things with their kids, as sometimes teachers are in the best place to do. So it calls out a couple of very important, I think, policy steps and builds on existing curriculum and existing reporting structures and pathways that are already there, and then calls out teen dating violence as a subset of those pathways and those curricula. So that's why it's not an unfunded mandate, but it actually does do something. It just does it as a subset of things that school districts are already required to do, if that makes sense.
Thank you.
If there's no other questions, because we have a number of young people that are ready to testify on this bill. Questions? Thank you for bringing this bill forward. Appreciate it. And really good on your researcher. Okay, we're going to start out with Elizabeth Nye, Cynthia Santiago, and is it Lily Santiago? Lexi? Okay, sorry. We welcome you this afternoon, and just know that we're not intimidating at all, and we're going to be good listeners.
Thank you so much for having us here today. My name is Elizabeth Nye. I'm the Executive Director of Girls Inc. of Northwest Oregon, and we've brought Cynthia and Lexi, both of whom are Girls Inc. girls, to talk to you today. We at Girls Inc. have been working towards a vision of empowering all girls to realize their rights and their potential in order to create a more equitable society. Our mission is to inspire girls to be strong, smart, and bold. We have been providing research-based gender-specific programming to girls ages 8 to 18 throughout the United States, and since 1945 have conducted extensive research on issues pertaining to girls. The reason we're here today is because this issue does predominantly affect girls, and I wanted to share with you a couple of stark facts about this. Girls especially experience gender-based violence, we know this, including this gender-based violence, as was mentioned before, often begins with sexual harassment at very young ages, and I have some research that I'd like to share with you about that. Girls and young women who witness or experience this violence, and I think it's interesting to talk about witnessing it and not just experiencing it, as we'll hear today from the girls, are more likely to be involved in risky behaviors themselves. Their exposure to violence often leads to involvement with the juvenile justice system. One in five girls in high schools is physically or sexually abused by a dating partner. It's an extensive problem. And 14 years of age is when a girl is most likely to be a victim of sexual assault. We believe at Girls Inc. that girls and boys can feel safer, and we believe that programs such as this that address both self-protection and community change are important to address this problem. What I want to talk to you about today is the fact that this bill points out programming for 7th through 12th graders. The American Association of University Women just conducted a report that was released in October of 2011 called Crossing the Line. They surveyed close to 2,000 students across the United States and found that 48% of students had experienced sexual harassment in the last school year. That was in 2010 and 11. The majority of these students, 87%, said that it had a negative effect on them, and that girls were more likely to be sexually harassed, and that this increased with age, which means that in 7th grade, boys and girls were being equally harassed, but by the time girls were in 12th grade, 62% of girls versus only 39% of boys reported experiencing sexual harassment. The report went on to detail some recommendations for interventions that had proven effective that I think are relevant to this discussion today. First of all, addressing sexual harassment and dating violence in a school's official agenda has been shown to work. Creating and publicizing a sexual harassment dating violence policy and sending a copy of that to parents has been shown to work. Providing clear guidelines about how staff can handle these issues is also important, and providing training on sexual harassment, dating violence for both students and staff work. One of the things that I thought was interesting after we actually had the researcher out to visit us in Portland a week and a half ago, and we held a focus group with fifth graders. In the discussion with those fifth graders, what we heard loud and clear was that already in fifth grade, these girls had witnessed these episodes and didn't know what to do with it. They didn't know who to tell. They didn't know what it meant for them, whether they were safe in their own world. And we have found that this is consistent with the research. Only 9% of students reported the incident to a teacher, a counselor, or another adult at the school. Fundamentally, Girls Inc. believes that girls have the right to have confidence in themselves and be safe in the world, but unfortunately, girls get mixed messages about how to respond to violence. They're told to depend on others to protect you, to get tough because only you can count on yourself, or to give in because your world can never be safe. This bill goes a long way towards sending a consistent message to girls that they can feel safe and be safer in their homes, schools, and communities, and we strongly urge you to support the legislation. So with that, I'd like to have...
My name is Cynthia. I'm 11 years old, and I'm in 6th grade, and I attend Astor K-8 school in North Portland. And this bill is important to me because I go about every day at school and I see my friends, you know, being bullied by other guys, and it really bothers me. And especially like in relationships too, when my friends are being bullied in relationships, it hurts not only them, but it hurts me too, because it hurts me to see other people in that kind of pain. And if girls are worrying about what's going on in their relationship, if they're going to get sexually harassed or anything like that, they're not going to be focusing on school, and they're going to be sidetracked from class. And I feel like if this bill is passed, it can really, like, make a difference, because, you know, you'll see that, you know, girls will go about feeling more confident about themselves. And if we can get, like, more programs in schools, such as Girls Inc., to make girls feel more confident and more safe to talk about these kinds of issues, it would really make a big difference in our world.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Lexi Santiago. I'm 13 years old and I'm in 7th grade. I attend Astor School in Portland. I participate in Girls Inc. programming, and I'm testifying to support the Oregon Bill 477. This bill is important because it helps prevent and stop this situation from happening. I know this girl who goes to my school, and she has been dating this boy. She's in 6th grade, and for a while, I noticed that she wasn't the same after that she was dating him. She came to me and told me that her boyfriend had tried to rape her and then started beating her up. She has no one to talk to at home or at school. If we had a program that could have helped her, this wouldn't have happened. It's really important for teens to know that help is out there and that they can be educated to know what to do in a situation like this. From my own experience, I feel that Girls Inc. programming is a place where I can go to build up the strength and confidence to talk, to stick up for myself and for a friend in a situation like this.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing your experiences. Any comments for this panel? Seriously, thank you. It's hard to deal with this. I used to be a middle school principal and a high school administrator, so yes, I know what students deal with day in and day out, so thank you.
Okay.
Is it Katie? Katie?
Mm-hmm.
And does somebody want to stay up here with Katie? And then is Megan Kovacs. Is Megan, okay, Megan, if you'd come up too. You can go ahead.
My name is Katie. I am 12 years old, and in 6th grade, I attend Creston School in Portland. I participate in Girls Inc. programming, and I am testifying in support of Oregon House Bill 4077. This bill is important because I feel if girls are not being treated well in a relationship, they will not be as happy in will not perform well in school. I know if that ever happened to me, I would tell someone right away. I think that a school program to help that would make an enormous difference. Girls Inc. helps girls stand up for themselves and say no if that ever happens to them. I know they have helped me understand a little better.
Thank you. Thank you for coming today. Mm-hmm. Megan, you okay there by yourself? Or?
I'm okay. Thanks.
Okay.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Megan Kovacs. I'm the education coordinator at Raphael House of Portland. For those of you that don't know, Raphael House is a domestic violence agency. In Portland, Oregon, we have a number of resources and programs that support survivors of domestic violence. As education coordinator, I run a program to primarily talk to high school and middle school students about domestic violence and healthy relationships. Over the past 5 years, I've worked with probably more than 10,000 students within my program, and have worked with countless survivors, talking about healthy and unhealthy relationships in classrooms, and laying a foundation for support, laying a foundation of understanding what a healthy relationship looks like and what people deserve from relationships. And, I've seen the impact of dating violence on many of the students that I've worked with. I'd like to read a quote that, I think really gets at the impact that dating violence has on the teenage psyche. Being abused in a relationship can shatter a teenager's belief that she is a worthy, decent, and independent person who can cope with life in a mature, self-assertive fashion. For the teen victim, the world becomes a frightening, confusing place where understanding how things are supposed to work is called into question. The victim's sense of her ability to protect herself and function autonomously is undermined. This is something that affects an entire community. Like one of the young women who was testifying said, it's not something that just directly affects the survivor. It also affects friends and family members, the people who are supporting that person through that process as well. I think there is a statistic by Sisters in Action in Portland, in Power, that shows in North and Northeast Portland about 75% of young women know someone, have a friend who has been or is currently in an abusive relationship. So this is something that is incredibly widespread and is affecting our community in a huge way. This is something that I, of course, deal with professionally and in my job, but it's also something that I've had to deal with personally. I think when I was in 6th or 7th grade, if you would have asked me if I would have ever known someone who had been in an abusive relationship, I would have said no, that doesn't happen to my friends. That doesn't happen to people that I know. But by the time I graduated from high school, one of my best friends was almost killed by her partner. She has found a safe place now. She is in a safe place, has gotten out of that relationship. She's in her late 20s now as well. Talking to her about this and talking to her about the work that I do, she has said that, education and a community that recognizes dating violence would have had a huge impact on her experience. If she had been in a school where there was dating violence policy, where people even called dating violence what it was, would have had a huge impact on, people intervening in what was happening. Everyone around her, she was involved in the drama club, she was in plays, everyone saw it happening, but no one called it what it was. And of course, this was 10 years ago, so it was, things have certainly changed exponentially. But I think, creating support in a community, creating support within our schools for people who are experiencing this is really a first step in creating a safer community for everyone. And that's why I testify in favor of this bill, because I think this is really a first step in creating a safer community for survivors and creating a community that not only addresses this, but also understands how we can really start creating change. And this is the first step in doing so. So thank you. And I wanted to make a side note, Representative Springer, I'm sorry I spelled your name wrong off the test.
I felt it's okay. Everybody spells one of my names
always.
If you want to stay, and then we'll have Amanda Schroeder and Sybil Hebb come up, and then if anybody on the committee has questions, then we have our three expert ladies here to help us out. Yeah, Amanda, if you want to start.
Thank you, co-chairs and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Amanda Schrader. I'm with the American Federation of Government Employees. I'm the National Women's Advisory Coordinator for District 11, within which I represent federal employees in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Montana, Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, and Alaska, Okinawa, and Guam. I also sit on our Human Rights Committee. Since the Violence Against Women Act passed in 1994, according to the Department of Justice, there has been an increase as much as 51% in reporting of domestic violence by women and 37% increase in reporting by men. AFGE believes that domestic violence is an issue that must be pursued and combated at all levels, and this is why we are so excited to support Oregon House Bill 4077, the Healthy Teen Relationship Act. Given the immediate and devastating effect of domestic violence on individuals and its communities, according to the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, the impact of domestic violence on American taxpayers is astronomical, with a figure upward of $37 billion annually. Children who witness domestic violence in the home are at the strongest risk of transmitting violent behavior from one generation to the next. Innovative and proactive legislation to combat the epidemic of domestic violence as a preventative measure such as Oregon House Bill 4077 is critical to improving the quality of life for our current and future generations by decreasing the likelihood of continued cycles of domestic violence. AFGE is committed to supporting legislation to protect jobs of victims of domestic violence and survivors of domestic violence, and we are absolutely committed to establishing preventative measures protecting current and future generations from the devastating impacts of domestic violence. As Representative Bailey said, there is great wisdom in the old adage, an ounce of prevention is worth more than a pound of the cure, and AFG strongly, strongly supports you to pass the Oregon House Bill 4077, the Healthy Teen Relationship Act.
Thank you. Sybil.
Thank you, Co-Chair Kump and members of the committee. Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center today in support of House Bill 477. I very much appreciate all of the work that's gone into this over multiple sessions now, and appreciate your giving it time on the agenda. You may wonder why the Law Center is interested in this issue. We provide civil legal services to low-income people. The reason that we're concerned about this bill and that we're so excited about it is that, unfortunately, almost a third of our cases are generated as a result of families dealing with the ramifications of domestic violence, either because of the impact on children, the impact on their housing or their jobs or their physical safety. And so we're very concerned about trying to get ahead of this and trying to put our state on a roadmap towards prevention and safety for all communities. As you all know, having been a part of discussions in this session and previously, we've done some good work around crime here in Oregon. Many crime rates are going down. The rate of domestic violence and sexual assault is not, unfortunately. And in fact, according to the CDC, a recently released study, our rates are actually significantly higher than many other states in the nation. So we don't have our arms around this right now. And there are, you know, the ultimate ramification of many of these cases is fatality. We've seen that on an increasing level over the past couple of years, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. And the rates here continue to be just a real problem, and not only in terms of the human toll, but also on the toll of our safety services, our public safety services, our human services, responding from the child welfare and self-sufficiency arenas. Our offices are struggling to manage it, and we really think that this bill, by setting a standard at the schools, will help to create a better environment for all of our young people. It'll help to create healthy patterns. Those patterns lead to other healthy patterns. We know that people who are victims end up with unhealthy eating habits, higher suicide rates, bad study rates, higher, lower achievement rates in school, mental health issues. I mean, the list just goes on. So we think this is a really great step in helping us to prevent future violence, also to learn more about it. For the record, this has a huge and overwhelming impact on women and children, most principally, we think, in the state of Oregon. But we are aware of a growing concern about the impact on boys, and this issue getting to people early, setting standards both for people who have the risk of being a perpetrator, whether they are boys or girls, or the risk of being a victim, whether they are boys or girls, is just equally important. So we really appreciate your attention to this. Thank you.
Thank you, Sybil. haven't seen you since I was in judiciary.
It's nice to see you.
Any questions or comments? Senator Monroe?
Yes, Sybil, I read somewhere a while back, I wanted to seal a case, that the second leading cause of death for women under 50 is being killed by a domestic partner, only exceeded by automobile accidents. Is that still the case?
Senator Monroe, Co-Chair Comp, that's correct. To my last understanding, I haven't looked at that particular statistic recently, so I don't know if there's been any update in the last year and a half, but it's a staggering impact, both in Oregon and nationally.
We're killing fewer people with automobile accidents, so maybe they're going for number one. That would be tragic. It's just horrible. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Shields?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I just want to really let you know how much we appreciate you continuing to bring this back, and Representative Bailey for your leadership on it. I think a lot of times we forget that in this state there's more to public safety than just building more and more prisons, and mm-hmm. we spend $1.4 billion in the prison budget, but yet in what DOJ and the domestic violence budget, it's about $7 or $8 million that we have to scrape for every year. And I think what I liked about this bill, and I think I don't have it in front of me right now, is that really all you're saying is, look, in that small pot of domestic violence funding, which should be frankly much larger now that we have a court settlement that should be helping us, but that's a topic for a different day, that you can put some of that into prevention, not just into services after the fact. And I think that's really the heart of what we're talking about here, is not a massive infusion of dollars, which we're scraping for, but just to say we're going to shift our priorities a little bit.
Thank you.
Very supportive of it. Any other comments? Sincere appreciation. This is something that I've been dealing with for a long, long time, and it is important. And thank you for testifying today and being here to put your own seal of personality to that. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4077. And I don't know that we have anything else for the good of the order. We do have a full agenda again on Wednesday. Mm-hmm. So Senator Monroe will be chairing. And thank all of you in the audience today. And we are adjourned.